Our first speaker is going to be Alex Ryboff, who is actually, he was born in the Ukraine, but he went to high school here in Brooklyn. He volunteered for the Marines. He was in the Marine Corps, the Marine Corps artillery unit that went into Iraq on March 20th, and was there until May. After coming back from Iraq, together with others, Alex became a co-founder of a new and very important organization, which is Iraq Veterans Against the War. And you know, that's obviously, you know, a very brave, very controversial, and I think very important step that has been taken. You know, those of us who remember Vietnam know how long it took before veterans were willing to speak out, and before you really had a veterans movement. You know, there were tens of thousands of Americans that were dead, millions of, or at least a million people in Southeast Asia that were dead before we started to hear dissent from veterans. So I think what Alex is, you know, working on is incredibly inspiring and courageous, and we're very glad to have him with us. The second speaker tonight is going to be Anthony Arnov, also a Brooklynite, a journalist, an author, an activist. I actually first met Anthony in his book, which I found extremely valuable, which he edited, which was Iraq Under Siege, The Deadly Impact of Sanctions and War. And Anthony has been didn't just write that, edit that very important volume, but was out there speaking about what was happening to Iraq as a result of the sanctions law through the 90s. And he has a new book that he's doing with Howard Zinn, Voices of the People in History. Am I saying that right? I ruined it. Tell me. Aha, okay, this is good. Voices of a People's History of the United States. My notes are perfect. Okay. Anyway, we're very glad to have Anthony. He's doing a lot of speaking, and I think it's very exciting that we have him here tonight. And our third speaker is Eric Gustafson, who is the executive director of an organization called EPIC, Education for Peace in Iraq Center, founded in 1998. I should say that Eric was a veteran of Gulf War I, and then became involved in Iraqi issues during the 90s, particularly active around the issue of the sanctions. I should also add, really, that he was a resource for Brooklyn Parents for Peace, because in the 90s, that was one of the things that we were very concerned about, were the sanctions in Iraq. And Eric was always the person we could call up and get advice about what was happening on the congressional level and, you know, what would be useful for us to do. And EPIC as well was active in the lead up to the war in opposing the war. Now, I'm going to let Eric speak for himself, but I think that the position of EPIC on the question of what the United States should do is somewhat different, and we'll let him talk for himself. In any case, we're really delighted that all three of you are here. Our format is going to be initial statements by the three. Then we're going to give them a chance to respond to each other. And I want to emphasize that part of why we're doing that is, you know, we can all hear these positions in isolation. But part of why we did this evening in the way that we have is so that we can hear a clash of ideas and a real discussion. So we'll have initial statements, some short cross-exchange, a few announcements, and then we'll open it up to the floor. So everybody clear about that? Okay, so our first speaker, I'm pleased to introduce, is Alex Ryboff.
As Rusty said, my name is Alex Ryboff. I'm 22 years old, and I joined the Marine Corps straight out of high school at 17 years old. My reasons in a nutshell for joining were money for college, health benefits, other great things that I would learn from the Marine Corps, discipline, honor, things like that. And also, I was still somewhat naive at 17 years old, so I was going to get a rifle, I was going to get to blow things up legitimately and get paid for it, so it seemed like a dream job. I went through boot camp, got my Eagle Globe and Anchor, and became a Marine. And, when I received this Eagle Globe and Anchor, my motivation was pretty high, but it steadily declined over my time in the Marine Corps. When I got to the fleet and I got to my unit, which is an artillery unit, I began to see what the real Marine Corps was about, which is including a lot of bureaucracy. You know, they'll tell you, work smarter, not harder. And there'll be, for example, a common sense, straightforward way to do something, and you'll be, you know, pretty much told to, you know, bend over backwards and jump through hoops to get it done. Nevertheless, you know, I continued on just, you know, in June to December of 2002, we're in Japan for a scheduled deployment. Towards the end of 2002, rumors began circulating that we'd be going to war with Iraq. You know, there was a buildup going on. In the news, everyone was being told Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. And, you know, Saddam was an imminent threat and all those things. And finally, at the beginning of January of 2003, we were told that, yes, we would be going to Iraq. Our commanding officer spoke to us briefly, and then himself and other officers went back inside. At this point, our first sergeant, who's the senior enlisted man in the unit, gathered us around and began to speak to us, sort of to somewhat prepare us for going over to Iraq. And he said, in going over there, don't think you're going to be heroes. Don't think you're going over to Iraq to topple Saddam Hussein, find weapons of mass destruction, or to bring democracy to the Iraqi people. He said, you're going there for one reason and one reason alone, and that's oil. Now, I'm being quite serious when I say this, and this man is a veteran of the First Persian Gulf War, has been in the Marine Corps 20-plus years, so he knows what he's talking about. But he continued in saying that you're still going to go because, one, you signed a contract, and two, you're going to make sure that the guy to the left and right of you comes back alive. So there's a reason, or there's a method to his madness. And we began to prepare our unit for going over to Iraq. This included packing up our vehicles, our guns, which are 155-millimeter howitzers, and the rest of our gear. I want to point out that this gear was, you know, it was not desert camouflage. It was green. So we had big green trucks, big green guns, and big green camouflage netting that we actually did put up in the middle of the desert. Now, you don't have to be even affiliated with the military to know that's not very smart. We also had, our vehicles were completely unarmored. As far as body armor goes, we only had one ballistic plate instead of two. You're supposed to have one for your chest and one to protect your back. So we went over to Kuwait in the middle of February. We were in Kuwait for a little bit over a month. And I believe it was the morning of the 18th at about 2:30 Kuwait time. We're woken up, told to get our things together, that we were moving out. As we began moving out, I know myself, I wasn't really afraid of, you know, bullets or conventional munitions that the Iraqis were going to use against us, but at that time there was, you know, still the fear of chemical and biological weapons. The very first night that we did begin attacking Iraq, we were still on the Kuwaiti border, because being artillery, you can fire upwards of 15 miles away, really reach out and touch someone, except when you touch somebody with artillery, there's nothing left of them. Some of the things that really made an impact on me during my time in Iraq were, for one, seeing dead bodies for the first time. A lot of times the firefights would take place in the middle of a road or anywhere else, and we passed through the area about, you know, 20, 30 minutes later, sometimes sooner than that. So we're passing through an area where a firefight had taken place, and there were these two dead Iraqi men lying in the middle of the road. One was lying sort of horizontal on top of the other one with his eyes wide open and, you know, glazed over. There was no doubt in my mind that he was dead. You know, you could tell that the man's soul was no longer in his body. One other thing, things I mentioned that, you know, artillery were firing upwards of 15 miles away, so you don't get to see what you're shooting at. And the result, as a result, you're somewhat desensitized from the killing. At one point, we were firing at an Iraqi artillery unit, and about 20, 30 minutes later, we're passing through the area where they had been, and we're told through our two-way radios to look to the right side of the road because that's where they'd be. I looked to the right side of the road, and I didn't see them. I expected to see maybe, you know, pieces of vehicles, you know, stuff like that. You know, I saw a piece of metal here, a piece of metal a little bit further down. Everything else looked like it had been put in a giant blender, spun around, poured back over the ground, just completely indistinguishable. And, you know, at the time I was in Iraq, I ended up, you know, blocking these things out because had I tried to deal with these things, I would have been, you know, no good to myself and no good to the rest of the unit. And then the thing that really, I believe, made the most impact on me was when we were moving up to Tikrit. The windshield of my vehicle, along with several other vehicles, had been blown out because of, you know, firing gunpowder charges weighing in excess of 48 pounds. And we're moving up to Tikrit. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning. The vehicle in front of us, the way artillery units work, the howitzer is towed behind the truck. And just so happens that the end of the barrel lines up directly with the windshield of the vehicle behind it. And the vehicle in front of us kicked up sand and dust and came to a stop as soon as they did this. We were unable to see them. It was like, you know, a smoke screen had been put up in front of us. By the time my driver did see their vehicle, it was too late, and we ran, directly into the howitzer. The howitzer, you can imagine, sort of a steel telephone pole went through where the windshield used to be, brushed my right shoulder, and went out the back of the cab. Then, you know, we backed up. The entire roof came off of our vehicle, fell to the ground, and we were told to, you know, get the pieces off the ground, and we had to keep going. When daylight hit, aside from smoking, a lot of cigarettes in a short period of time, I looked at my right shoulder. And as you see in the desert, uniforms are, you know, light beige color, something like that. This entire shoulder was totally pitch black from the carbon and gunpowder residue from the barrel, meaning that had it been another 6 inches to my left, I wouldn't be here right now. And coming back from Iraq, we came back at the end of May of 2003. And when we had been over there, when we began the initial push into Iraq, you know, Iraqi people were on the sides of the road, you know, waving to us, cheering, things like that. Kids were asking for candy. I remember, you know, one negative thing we did see was an old Iraqi woman thumbing her nose at us. And that was pretty self-explanatory. And in a way, I guess it was sort of, you know, foreshadowing things to come. When we did come back, end of May, beginning of June, the sentiment of the Iraqi people began to shift. Attacks began being stepped up, IEDs, things like that. And CNN was on in the chow hall, or, you know, the cafeteria. So every single meal that I was eating, I was seeing the body count continue to rise on both sides. And after a while, something just, you know, snapped in me, and I realized that, you know, this war, you know, with everything else taken aside, was a complete waste of human life for both sides, and I realized that I was against it. The problem is that at this point, I still had about a year left in the Marine Corps, so I really had to, you know, bite my tongue, because had I spoken my mind, had I, you know, told my superiors and such how I felt, I would have very likely lost the benefits that I had almost died to keep. I finally got out of the Marine Corps, came home in the middle of May of 2004. At that point, I knew I was against the war. I had all this anger and frustration, but really no outlet for it. Michael Hoffman, who was in my unit, he had gotten out about a year before I did, and I knew he was begin participating in peace movement rallies, things like that. He called me up at the beginning of June, said there was a peace rally in Manhattan, and, you know, maybe I should attend. I showed up, and I expected to see people our age, you know, maybe early to mid-20s, you know, things like that. The people I met were World War II veterans, Korean War veterans, Vietnam veterans, and, you know, veterans all the way up to the current conflict, including families who had lost, you know, sons, you know, friends and loved ones over there. And I began to see, you know, how extensive the peace movement really was. From there, at the end of July of 2004, we actually officially started Iraq Veterans Against the War in Faneuil Hall in Boston. Since then, we've been doing things ranging from, you know, phone interviews to, you know, speak-outs like this, forums, debates, things like that. Now, I'd like to get into you know, our official position as far as Iraq Veterans Against the War, and that is we are calling for the immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. The fact is that we should not have gone into Iraq to begin with, whereas, and, you know, this is a topic unto itself, but the war in Afghanistan actually had some types of reasonings for it. Well, you know, bin Laden and al-Qaeda are responsible for 9/11. They're in Afghanistan. Let's go to Afghanistan to get them. In the case of Iraq, there was no clear line of reasoning. Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction, which I'd like to point out the U.S. had sold to them to begin with, and, you know, a lot of people conveniently forget this. Saddam was not an imminent threat because even if he had those weapons of mass destruction, he did not have the means to get them over to the United States. And as far as, you know, him being an evil dictator and committing all kinds of crimes against people, there are plenty of evil dictators throughout the world, but that doesn't mean that, you know, we need to parade around like, you know, the world police with a nightstick, and, you know, you can't go invading every single country as, you know, human rights violations, things like that. And the thing is, since the invasion of Iraq, you know, there are estimates as to how many Iraqi civilians have been killed. The lower end of the estimates are somewhere from 10 to 14,000, and the higher end, which I believe is a lot more accurate, is close to 100,000. And this is not including Iraqi military, so not including Farin or foreign fighters or insurgents or anything like that. Not to mention that, you know, upwards of 1,500 U.S. troops have been killed, and that number is, this is also sort of going off on a tangent, is not accurate because suicides are not counted, vehicle accidents are not counted. Older troops that have been in for a while as they're dying are actually retired. So, you know, they're not counted in the complete death toll. And also, upwards of 10,000 U.S. troops have been injured. And that's ranging anywhere from, you know, losing a finger or a toe to, you know, guys coming back with, you know, both arms missing, severe head trauma, things like that. And the dead and wounded are being brought back under cover of night to really, you know, hide the cost of this war from the American people. They're brought into Walter Reed through side exits, things like that, long after, you know, the hours are closed. And from the time that we came into Iraq, the Iraqi people, the ones that I saw, they really, some of them were happy to see us because they thought we'd bring about some good, some, you know, some change. And when we took down Saddam Hussein, we, you know, got rid of the Ba'ath Party and the Iraqi military, I thought that was, you know, our mission would be finished, you know, wrap things up and come back home. That wasn't the case. Now you have, you know, U.S. Marines, Army, and other forces that are not trained as occupying forces. They're trained to go in, accomplish an objective, you know, eliminate enemy forces, and, you know, and that's it. Now these same forces are being used really to, you know, police the Iraqi people. They're being used to try to control certain areas where, you know, military units instead of politicians, things like that, are given control of an area, and they're charged with keeping order, make sure no looting, things like that go on. And the Iraqi people, they have completely, you know, we've completely lost the trust of them. You have U.S. troops, you know, kicking down the doors of houses in the middle of the night because there's suspicion that the husband or, you know, they have another family member, a male of a military age, that they're somehow involved with the insurgents, things like that. You have, you know, vehicles running checkpoints. This has happened countless of times, that vehicle run a checkpoint, it'll get shot up, and then the troops doing the shooting will go to check the vehicle only to realize that it was just civilians, and they had just found out they had just killed an entire family, things like that. Really, to kind of sum things up, the Iraqi people do not want this in their country. And the way the word insurgent has sort of been misused in the news, you'd make it seem like it's a new term for bad guy or something like that, when the real definition of insurgent is someone who's rebelling against established authority, especially government. And that's exactly what the Iraqi people are doing. Now, in terms of people saying that we cannot withdraw our troops because Iraq would, you know, fall into chaos, we are the ones causing the chaos right now. We are, you know, the ones that are responsible for a lot of the killings, whether intentional or unintentional, vehicles running checkpoints, bombing runs gone astray, things like that. And also, a lot of times where you have insurgent attacks aimed at U.S. military, you have a lot of Iraqi people that are getting caught in the crossfire, that are getting caught sort of, you know, this is sort of misuse of the term, but in a way becoming like collateral damage in their attempts to kill, maim, and, you know, destroy the U.S. military presence in the area. I just like to end with saying that we should call for the immediate withdrawal of our troops, and really our government has taken us into Iraq, and I believe that we should leave it up to them to come up with, and, you know, supervise, to come up with a strategy to get out of Iraq.
We find ourselves in a remarkable situation today that I think we have to take stock of, which is that despite all of the pro-war propaganda from the corporate media, and despite what I would argue has been the quiescence of much of the left over the last year, a majority of people in the United States today believe that the consequences of the war, the invasion of Iraq, were not worth it, and are now opposing and questioning this war in a fundamental way, and particularly are questioning the rising consequences of this war in their communities, like the communities in Vermont that have passed a resolution about the National Guard troops that are being sent to this conflict, like the communities of military families and veterans who are speaking out against this war. The official justifications for the war have all been exposed as complete fallacies. No weapons of mass destruction have been found, no connections between Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi government and al-Qaeda or the attacks of September 11th. The occupation has not paid for itself, as Paul Wolfowitz told us it would in the lead up to the war, saying, no, no, these estimates of how much it will cost, how many troops it will take, are all wrong. And U.S. soldiers, as Alex pointed out, have not been greeted as liberators by the Iraqi people. Meanwhile, on the ground in Iraq today, there are more Iraqis in prison than at any point during the occupation. It's now up to around 8,900 officially detained, including people who are still detained in the Abu Ghraib prison, where the most extreme instances of torture and abuse took place, but which by no means is unique. There are almost certainly people who aren't being counted in those official numbers because the United States is holding people outside of any possible international inspection, whose numbers aren't contributing to that number. The British medical journal The Lancet has estimated in a very rigorous study that as many as 98,000 excess deaths have occurred in Iraq as a consequence of the invasion in 2003. That's not counting people who've been killed by military occupation, people who were killed, for example, in the siege of Fallujah. Electricity in Iraq remains at below levels even that they were under the severe sanctions that the country was subjected to under Saddam Hussein. $8 billion of money that was supposedly sent to Iraq for reconstruction efforts has gone completely missing, totally unaccounted for. Unemployment, internal displacement, lack of access to safe drinking water, all of these problems continue to profoundly plague the people of Iraq. And as Alex pointed out, people continue to be humiliated and killed and abused in the house-to-house searches, which are going on still with the participation of U.S. soldiers, although sometimes accompanied by local proxies. Iraqis are killed routinely with complete impunity at checkpoints, in these raids, in these attacks. And we've seen in example after example that when evidence of abuse emerges, certainly none of the officials are held responsible. None of the people overseeing the policies that allowed the torture in Abu Ghraib to take place, none of the people who are setting the framework for the rules of engagement in Iraq are being held accountable. But also, more and more, we see examples of soldiers directly involved in the abuse and in killings being let off. Just a few weeks ago, another example of that. And yet many of the people who spoke out against this invasion, who marched on February 15th, who opposed sanctions for years before that, now are suggesting that the U.S. troops should stay in Iraq for the benefit of the Iraqi people, that the people who have been carrying out these abuses, these crimes, who have been involved in torture and killing, and before that in sanctions on Iraq, that the U.S. government, the military troops it sent into Iraq, should stay for the benefit of the Iraqi people. Thus, we confront a strange situation of the anti-war movement mobilizing against a war and then supporting an occupation that is a direct result of that war. I think it's an incoherent position and one that we have to absolutely reject. Not having found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which was the first big lie of this invasion. The Bush administration has come up with a new big lie, and that is that Donald Rumsfeld, George Bush, Condoleezza Rice, Paul Wolfowitz are bringing democracy to the Iraqi people. But democracy has absolutely nothing to do with why the United States is in Iraq. And in fact, the United States has no interest in seeing democracy in Iraq. The Bush administration invaded Iraq in 2003 for reasons of straight power politics, having to do with the U.S. desire to control Middle Eastern energy resources. Iraq has the world's second largest oil reserves. It sits in a region with two-thirds of the world's oil reserves. And it has been a central axiom of U.S. foreign policy for decades that the U.S. will control those resources, not so that it can import all of that oil into the Middle East, from the Middle East into the United States, but so that it can control oil as a weapon of political power, that it can use oil as a weapon against military and economic competitors, increasingly who are importing and are dependent on those same energy resources from the Middle East. So, for example, Europe, Japan, China, India import more of their energy resources from that region, and we have countries like China and India that are rapidly growing, that need to export, need to import more oil, and are looking to the Middle East for their energy resources. And the U.S. wants to maintain its control over the Middle Eastern energy resources as a leverage against any potential economic or military rival in the future. If you look at the National Security Strategy document of the United States, which was released in September of 2002, it lays this out very clearly, that the U.S. wants to preserve the enormous gap that exists between itself and its potential military competitors, as well as the enormous gap between itself and any other potential, what's called peer competitor, economically in the global stage. And the U.S. saw an opportunity in going into Iraq to extend its regional hegemony and thereby extend its global hegemony on the world stage. The hope of the United States in invading Iraq was to install a more favorable regime, one that would allow it to have military bases in Iraq, and it also hoped, by going into Iraq, to have a staging ground for other intervention in the region, including military intervention and, of course, extending the doctrine of regime change, if it were possible, to other regimes that threatened U.S. interests, that were destabilizing factors in the region, particularly Syria and Iran. We now know that the U.S. is establishing bases, hoping that they will become permanent bases in Iraq, and that the U.S. has the largest embassy that it has in the world today in Baghdad. And this has nothing to do with democracy. It's important to remind ourselves of the history of U.S. intervention in the Middle East, how the U.S. has consistently backed undemocratic regimes, whether Islamist or not, as long as those regimes ensured stability for the region, and how the United States has consistently undermined any popular, democratic, nationalist, communist, socialist, secular movement that might challenge the status quo in the region. Of course, this was illustrated with the support for the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran in 1953, and then, of course, the support for the brutal regime of the Shah of Iran that followed. It's also the reason the United States, for years, was allied to Saddam Hussein, armed him, trained him, provided him with strategic and military intelligence, and stood by the Iraqi government during the worst of its crimes against the Kurds, against the Iraqi people, against the Iranians, against whom Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons. All of those things occurred with the patronage and support of the United States. And then those very crimes were then trotted out in 1991 and again in 2003 to justify military intervention by the United States. The U.S. opposes genuine democracy in the Middle East for a few very simple reasons, one of which is that if the ordinary people of the region had a say in really determining things, they might use the profits from the oil resources of that region for social development and for human need, rather than those resources and the profits from them going to the major multinational oil companies based in the United States and in the West. That's why, if you look at what the United States did in Iraq, it established a transitional administrative law and passed more than 100 resolutions that will outlive the occupation, imposing neoliberal measures, imposing austerity measures on Iraq that will be binding on whatever government comes to power. These involve opening every aspect of Iraq's economy other than oil to 100% foreign ownership. They've retained the anti-worker laws that were set up under the regime of Saddam Hussein. And they've lowered taxes on the rich and on corporations in Iraq to standards that would only be dreamed of by the most greedy corporations in the United States. And they have ensured that while Iraqi oil will not be turned over to 100% foreign ownership, it will de facto be controlled by private companies and dominated by Western oil giants. Even the New York Times ran a column by Jeff Madrick, a mainstream economist, who said that the consequences of these policies will be, as he put it, widespread cruelty. This is what he wrote. By almost any mainstream economist standard, the plan is extreme, in fact, stunning. It would immediately make Iraq one of the most open to trade and capital flows in the world and put it among the lowest taxed in the world, rich or poor. The new plan reduces the top personal income and corporate tax rate to only 15%. It reduces tariffs on imports to 5%, and it abolishes almost all restrictions on foreign investment. It would allow a handful of foreign banks to take over the domestic banking system. This is about neoliberalism, and it's about U.S. control, economic control, and political control, not about helping the Iraqi people. And it's not just anti-war activists in the United States or abroad who are coming to these conclusions. As Alex just eloquently pointed out, soldiers who are being sent to Iraq, reservists who are being called up for duty, see through these lies. As one member of the Texas Army National Guard said on March 15th on Democracy Now!, "I believe it's an unjust war on our part. I do not believe what the government has told us." "I do not believe this government intends to spread democracy in the Middle East. It's not in the interests of their security or our security. I believe it's all about oil and profits." And another soldier said this on the same show on March 15th. "When I first went to Iraq, I actually believed what the government was saying, that we were searching for weapons of mass destruction. We were making the country safe for democracy and things like that. But when we got there, I quickly found another story. I quickly found that the Iraqis didn't want us there. If the soldiers had come into our country and had invaded us and had come into our homes, then I would have fought back too. I was seeing how the war felt from a lot of the Iraqis' point of view. Soldiers and their families and veterans are speaking out against this war. It's a vital part of the anti-war movement, and it takes a lot of courage, and it's something that we absolutely have to support." A final argument that I want to address is the idea that the United States has an obligation to the Iraqi people and therefore has to stay to clean up the mess that it created to bring stability to Iraq. I think it should be clear by now that rather than bringing stability, the U.S. occupation is the source of instability and the source of ongoing suffering and violence. Washington isn't preventing civil war from breaking out. In fact, it's actively increasing factionalism and infighting among various groups in Iraq to serve its own interests. We have to do everything that we can to force the United States out of Iraq so that the Iraqi people can determine their own future. The U.S. has no business lecturing people around the world about democracy. Given the lack of democracy here at home and given the history of the U.S. attempts to quote-unquote impose democracy around the world, does the U.S. have an obligation to Iraqi people? Absolutely. And if we lived in a just world, when the U.S. was forced out of Iraq, it would be forced to pay reparations to the Iraqi people for the years during which it supported Saddam Hussein, for the years of sanctions, and for the crimes of this occupation. It should also be forced to pay reparations to the soldiers, their families, and the communities that are being torn apart by this war. And I'll just end with something that Mark Twain said when he was observing the imposition of democracy in the Philippines, which involved the massacre of thousands upon thousands of the Filipino people. He said, "I am opposed to the eagle putting its talons on any other land." And I think he was absolutely right. And like Mark Twain did in his day, I think we need a new anti-imperialist league today to oppose the U.S. putting its talons on any other land. And we have to start right now by getting the U.S. out of Iraq.
Before I get started, and briefly, I'm Eric Gustafson, the director of the Education for Peace in Iraq Center, an organization that focuses on improving humanitarian conditions, defending the human rights of the Iraqi people, and bringing about democratic change in Iraq. And we've actually been, in fact, around since 1998, and our message has never changed over those years. I want to pass around sign-up sheets. I've got some amazing people in the office that spend week after week compiling the best news coverage in dispatches that we send out by email. And we're one of those organizations that only send out maybe one email per month, but it's an email that you definitely always want to get, so I want to pass those around. I also should mention that while the organization, EPIC's board of directors and myself, do have a clear position, we do not support immediate withdrawal. However, we also do not believe the U.S. can stay in Iraq. Not all of our subscribers agree with that position, and there's often lively discussion. So those of you that are actually subscribed to those dispatches already, you'll know that our readers' rights section is one of the more interesting discussions. I came here, normally I stay holed up in my office in Washington. I do that because I feel like the change that has to happen right now is me and so many others, both inside the government, believe it or not, and also outside of the government with the different non-governmental organizations, really trying to bring about direct policy change. There are policy battles. There are unbelievable policy battles going on in Washington right now. And there are huge opportunities as well. So that's been a lot of my focus, and it's really pulled me away from the grassroots side of things. However, the grassroots end of things is absolutely crucial as well. And I absolutely commend Alex and Anthony and Carolyn, Brooklyn Parents for Peace. It was amazing, actually, getting her phone calls in the lead-up to the invasion. I see a few familiar faces in the crowd, those mass rallies. We can't forget that. It was, by far, I think, the strongest, broadest anti-war effort that this country has seen since the latter years of the Vietnam War. And it was, I think it was incredibly diverse in many ways. You had, you know, organizations that represented the radical left. You had organizations that were mainstream, like Patriots for Peace, trying to show that it's also patriotic to oppose the rush to war. It was an absolutely incredible time. The churches have never been more united against the war. NGOs, civil society groups have never been more united against the war. And we can't forget that. But here's the challenge, and this is where we're at today, which is so different. A lot of the effort to try to prevent the war, the debate, pro-war, anti-war, in the lead-up of the war, were more than appropriate and can't be forgotten in terms of our own health as a democracy. But at this point, this podium right here is the war. You can support it, or you can oppose it, but it's still going to sit here. The key difference between what's happening in Iraq and what we saw in Vietnam is in the case of Vietnam, we clearly knew that once the United States left Vietnam, the war would end. And that's indeed what happened. We also clearly understood who would take over, who would be in charge when we left. And that indeed happened as well. In the case of Iraq, we don't know. And just as I saw the issue of Iraq politicized, highly politicized during the years of sanctions, I see it continue to be highly politicized to this day. And I see it politicized by everyone, you know, whether it's partisan politics inside the Beltway or it's the discussions that I see when I am on the lecture circuit. I'll give you one example of how it gets politicized. You talk with you know, the president or the White House communication staff? And how are they going to characterize what's happening in Iraq? How do they characterize the insurgency, anti-Iraq forces, right? Or terrorism? You talk with a number of close friends of mine who are very active and doing incredible work, anti-war work right now. I'll talk with them and ask them, you know, what's going on in Iraq, and they'll talk about the violence as though it's only a resistance. You know, all the violence is coming from a resistance. It shows you how politicized it gets. I want to be really clear. There is a mix of factors and sources of violence in Iraq right now. U.S. forces is only one source of violence. In terms of a resistance, there is a resistance. It's because of the incredible, colossal failures of this administration in not adequately preparing for the aftermath. The decision to invade Iraq in the first place, but failing to address the aftermath, allowing the chaos to go after, to go month after month after month. I mean, I had Iraqi friends say to me, oh, some of my older Iraqi friends who had lived through the decades of coups in the 1950s or the 1960s, and they said that they couldn't understand. I mean, don't the Americans know how to run a proper military coup? You know, you topple the regime, you capture the airwaves, you tell everyone that there's an immediate curfew, go back home, you clear the streets, it's about trying to establish order as quickly as possible, you say show up to your jobs the following morning, and it's about capture, capturing the top of a regime and trying to maintain the order. That's not what we saw. And very quickly, a lot of Iraqis began to question our intentions for very good reasons. If we were still on the same original script that I believe the neocons, Paul Wolfowitz, Paul Bremer, and others had, Paul Bremer would still be in Baghdad right now. Iraq's oil sector would be in the process of being privatized. There would have not been elections. And we would be going down the road of seeing Iraq become the next Vietnam. However, the neocon dream ran up against a huge barrier, and it's called reality. And it's what the Iraqis, the obstacles that the Iraqis themselves, Iraqi leadership, as well as the resistance, created for them. But it was because of that original script that we saw a resistance. It's not just anti-Iraq forces. We are seeing a resistance concerned about U.S. intentions. Some of that is changing, and I would argue that what's crucial about the resistance is bringing as many as of those that are part of the resistance into the political process. Second, the second factor and source of a lot of the violence we're seeing is an insurgency. We're talking about an organized effort to use violence to overthrow a constituted government, in this case, a transitional government. We are talking about an effort to prevent any change in the political order. This includes a lot of those that were formerly part of the regime. And again, part of this is fueled by huge failures on the part of the Bush administration. Disbanding Iraq's national army, not a really smart idea. Hundreds of thousands of men out on the streets with guns, not you know. The purging of civil servants, we're talking of somewhere in the neighborhood of 30,000 at least civil servants who were members of the Ba'ath Party. They had to join the party to be able to protect their families, to advance in their careers. You know, they also were turned out, many of them, summarily. That really fueled an insurgency, because if people in certain provinces like Nineveh province, where we saw a very small voter turnout, about I think it was 12 or 19%, or Anbar province voter turnout around 2%, we're talking about provinces that don't feel like they have a stake in Iraq's future, and as a result, people will tend to resort to violence to try to prevent the change that they fear might be coming. The third element, and this we saw starting in August 2003 and getting worse and worse. I was on my honeymoon in Nova Scotia when I got word of the terrorist attack of the UN headquarters. In many ways, I've talked with UN officials, and to this day, it's as though I walked into the State Department under the Clinton administration shortly after the Black Hawk Down incident. My wife is in Rwanda right now, And we're about to see the anniversary of the genocide that took place there. The inability of the Clinton administration, the State Department, to respond to a clear genocide is connected to what had occurred in Somalia and a complete resistance on the part of Washington D.C. any risk of, to put any Americans at similar risk to be able to prevent a genocide in Rwanda. That is a grave injustice that we cannot allow again. The terrorism that we saw with the attack on the UN and has continued, over 170 were killed during the Ashura festivals when targeting Shiite pilgrims a couple years ago. This past year, the most recent Ashura festival, another 70 were killed. The targeting of civilians in Hilla, we see it over and over again. And the terrorism, in many cases, is getting worse. So those are the three factors. Those are the three sources of violence. And that is what we leave the Iraqi people to if we leave before the transitional government, the Iraqi people, have the sufficient means to be able to provide for their own security. And that's why I do not support an immediate withdrawal. However, there has to be a move towards withdrawal, and I strongly argue that the most responsible way out of Iraq is through capacity building. And capacity building doesn't mean the United States goes, you know, with our people and build institutions. No, it's about providing Iraqis with the assistance they need to build their institutions. I want to briefly touch on that, and EPIC's peace plan. Because there's four goals that we need to start seeing progress on, and we need to start seeing it very fast. The first goal is the protection of civilians and human rights. Abu Ghraib, awful failure. We're still seeing abuses of human rights, both at the hands of Americans, I believe, but also at the hands of Iraq's transitional government. That can't happen. We need to see a growing of Iraq's institutional capacity for security, the rule of law, and the prevention of corruption. Corruption is a serious issue. It's a legacy of Saddam's regime. It's also the product of the past 2 years of chaos. The $8.8 billion that can't be fully accounted for, well, it's because the entire banking system crashed in Iraq. Ministries didn't have adequate records in terms of payroll because of the looting and destruction that happened. Money was being delivered, cash bundles of money, millions of dollars were being delivered to ministries to be able to maintain payroll and try to get things restarted. And there was insufficient accountability when those billions of dollars were being dispersed. And by the way, that wasn't our money, that was Iraq's own oil revenue. Third, Iraqi-led reconstruction and job creation is a huge issue. During the Great Depression, our own unemployment here went beyond 25% and was seen as destabilizing, as a national security threat. And we had WPA and other efforts to be able to put Americans back to work. It's the same case in Iraq. We're seeing unemployment in rates of 30% in some of the provinces among employable men. And they become recruits in terms of the insurgency. And then finally, increased political inclusion and reconciliation. Of course, whenever I talk policy, I feel like I'm putting people to sleep, so I'll get back on other messages. But I want to be very clear about this. We are seeing some progress, and a lot of the progress we're seeing is driven by Iraqi politics. But there's also some issues of concern. In terms of progress, 64 Sunni clerics and scholars issuing a fatwa, encouraging Sunni Arabs to join and cooperate with Iraq's emerging security forces. That's progress. The announcement today with the formation of a transitional government, we're a step closer, we're not quite there. The transitional administrative law that the U.S. Advised at times a heavy-handed way, I think is somewhat of a straitjacket. The more that Iraq takes steps away from the legacy of Paul Bremer, whether it's the elections with 8 million Iraqis turning out to vote or the formation of a transitional government, and then also the writing of their own constitution that they determine themselves and direct elections, every single one of those steps away from U.S. control, and also coupled with capacity building, the kind of assistance Iraqis really need. And there are billions of dollars that have yet to be spent, by the way, that has already been allocated by Congress. The more that's done, the more we create conditions that can allow for a responsible withdrawal. Thanks.
Thank you, everybody. What we said we would do here is, before opening this up to the floor, is to give the panelists an opportunity to respond to each other. And I think with the last set of remarks, the issues are sort of pretty sharply drawn, I think. And what we sort of said is that we'll give each panelist up to 5 minutes. And the order there will be Alex going first, and then Eric, and then Anthony. Have I got that right? Okay. So Alex, would you like to respond?
Thank you. Okay. Eric mentioned the establishment of the Iraqi security forces. Now, last time I checked the number on those, they were numbering of roughly 14,000. I'd just like to jump real quick to the fact there are roughly 130,000 U.S. troops in Iraq right now trying to control a population of about 23 million. And, you know, we're being told that as soon as the Iraqi security forces are up to par, they'll be able to take over for the U.S. troops. At this rate, it doesn't seem like they'll be able to do that anytime soon. The fact is that, you know, we've just reached the, passed the two-year mark since the invasion began, and the U.S. Has yet to establish and maintain security for the Iraqi people. There are routine kidnappings of women and children. Women are being, sold into slavery, sold into prostitution in other countries, held for ransom, executed, things like that. Anthony mentioned before, basic services like electricity, water, healthcare, and education have not been restored. Also, as far as the local economy, Iraqis are not able to, go out like we would to a store, be able to, purchase things that they need for everyday, groceries, have clean drinking water, stuff like that. And as far as the elections go, the elections in Iraq, there can be a parallel drawn from the, I believe it was the 1967 elections in Vietnam. And the New York Times actually printed during that election how, after this election, that things were looking up, and this was going to lead to a more stable government in Vietnam, and everyone knows how that turned out. And I very strongly believe that these elections, even though to some Iraqi people maybe yet another sign for hope, I believe that these elections in the end will really not make much of a difference in terms of restabilizing Iraq and putting into power a feasible government. And also, as far as the other problems that the U.S. is facing in Iraq, the fact is that a lot of U.S. troops do not completely understand the culture, not completely understand the people. And that's where a lot of the misunderstandings and, unintentional killings come from. So beyond that, if after 2 years, the Bush administration, with the use of its troops and, the use of diplomats and such, have not established, first of all, this is not even stating that, the war should not have taken place to begin with. But if after 2 years, the United States and the Bush administration have not been able to stabilize the government in Iraq, and since the presence of U.S. troops is the main problem over there, it would kind of it would seem common sense. It would seem that it's only a feasible solution to remove the U.S. troops from the equation and then move on from there. Thank you.
If I could, there's always been a grave question as to whether I could be a fair moderator or quiet moderator. But I'd actually like to sort of step in just to Eric is going to speak in a moment and just sort of follow up on Alex just in terms of a question, because there's a lot of agreement among the three of you in terms of how the United States has performed so far in Iraq. So I think that the difference that I'm hearing from the speakers is that whereas two of the speakers think that what's happened so far is kind of an indicator of what's likely to happen, that in your remarks you're posing the question of, there are all these things we haven't done very well, let's do them better now. And so one question I would like to ask you to respond to is that what makes you think that they will do anything better than they've done before? What possible reason is there to imagine that that would happen? So I'm just sneaking that in, but go ahead.
Briefly, because some of the folks that created this mess in the first place have gotten their big asses out of the way. Some of them have also been sent out to pasture. I know that it's been interpreted that Wolfowitz going to the World Bank is about the Bush administration trying to capture the bigger stage in terms of changing the world. No, it's about putting them out to pasture. The World Bank has far less to do with the policy battles in Washington. He is now out of the policy battles in Washington, which is great. John Bolton, another problem, he's out of the policy battles in a large degree because he's now taking orders from the State Department. He's our, possibly, if he's confirmed, our next ambassador to the UN. I'm not excited about either of those moves, but I am seeing a lot of the neocons that created this mess not being big players and being in almost full retreat in Washington. I am not going to go into the details of all of the ways that I see things changing in terms of U.S. policy because I would really put you all to sleep. But what I can share with you is some significant changes that we saw, and actually many of you helped bring about. Many of your members of Congress helped bring about. One of them is getting the Pentagon out of being in control of nation building in Iraq, or as the Republicans now like to call it, post-conflict reconstruction. That was a huge step in the right direction. I know a lot of the people at the State Department. I have a lot of confidence in them. I'm not talking about the senior officials necessarily, but I'm talking about the mid-level officials. These are folks that spent time in the non-governmental sector and know best practices. Some of them even spent time working with UN agencies. They know what's up in terms of how to create jobs, how to shift money, how to really empower and provide a lot of the assistance that Iraqis need. We are seeing change. Part of what frustrates me, and this is especially frustrating for a lot of my Iraqi friends, as Westerners or Americans, where we take a lot for granted, we take for granted for the fact that there's an institution here, there's many overlaying institutions, there's more security. I'm from Washington, D.C., that's one of the murder capitals of the United States, live on a street right downtown, but even I feel relatively safe given all the institutions and the strength of those institutions. We can't take that for granted. A lot of that was in disrepair. We can't forget the impact of sanctions as well as the tyranny of Saddam Hussein for decades. We can't ignore how much the looting and chaos set things back in Iraq. And that's what the Iraqi people are having to deal with right now. And so it's building to a point. A year ago, I was close to losing all hope. But now I feel a lot more optimistic about things. And it's optimism not grounded in any being naive that suddenly better intentions are prevailing at the White House, but it's that there's more opportunities for the people who know a little bit more about what needs to happen being able to make more of a difference. A few quick words, because I wanted to respond to Alex. Again, Iraq is not Vietnam. It makes sense that many of us look at Iraq through the lens of Vietnam because Vietnam is something that we know. I mean, it's part of our popular culture. But looking at things like the elections in Vietnam, I mean, there were supposed to be elections far earlier in Vietnam, and the United States ended up derailing that process, correct? And then when the elections were staged, they were staged. It wasn't the kind of free and fair and open elections, because had there been those kinds of elections, then I think we would have seen possibly not those that sided with the Viet Cong winning, but we would have seen, I think, different results than we actually saw. It was a huge challenge for the United States. My father spent two tours in Vietnam. It's not something that I fully understand, but it's something I grew up with and the legacy of that, including an uncle who died from an aggressive form of cancer that's believed to be linked to Agent Orange. But looking at those elections, when the elections were held in 1967, approximately about 20% of Vietnamese who were eligible to vote according to age, only about 20% voted. In the case of the elections in Iraq, 57% voted. There's a slight difference between those two numbers. It's not to say that there weren't any problems with the elections. And like I said, every step towards those direct elections is a step away from U.S. control and is a step toward Iraqi self-rule. So we need to continue to support that process. In terms of Iraq's security forces, Iraq's new army now has about 30,000 troops. And this is a much lower figure, by the way, than you'll hear coming from some officials. But based on what I've seen, it's about 30,000. Of those 30,000 troops in the new military, about 75% of the officers had served under the previous regime. This is not a bad thing, because this means that we're talking about a lot of Sunni Arab officers. A lot of the officer class in Iraq came from the Mosul area. So it's important that we continue to work to bring in that leadership, because what it's ultimately about is isolating the terrorism and ending it, and then with the insurgency and the resistance, finding ways to bring the resistance and the insurgency into the political process so that people resort to nonviolence means in terms of political contest rather than seeing a continuation of the violence and possibly leading to something far, far worse. And by the way, what we're seeing in Iraq isn't even close to how bad it could be. Right now, it's relatively unsafe, and particularly unsafe in certain areas, in four provinces. There are 18 provinces in Iraq. So if you think things are bad now, again, it's that tendency as Americans, we look at the specific cases of violence which are reported on, but we ignore the fact that there's a much broader context. And a lot of Iraqis see that and recognize that things could get a lot worse than they are right now.
Eric referred to Fallujah as a failure, and I think it's more useful to understand Fallujah referred to Abu Ghraib as a failure. I think it's much more useful to understand Abu Ghraib as a logical extension of this occupation, and to understand that the moment the United States went in, we knew that there would be Abu Ghraibs, and as long as the United States continues to be in Iraq, there will be more abuses and more crimes like it. It's a logical outcome of trying to impose your will on a people against their will. And I'm afraid that it sounds like the logic of your position, Eric, is to advise the U.S. on how to run its occupation more effectively. I think we should be having a conversation about how to end the occupation and let the Iraqi people determine their own future. I think that there is, at heart, a very elitist and racist argument, which is very popular in the media right now, which says that the Iraqi people cannot run their own society, that the Iraqi people don't understand democracy, that the Iraqi people can't build their own institutions. I think we have to fundamentally reject that idea. Iraq has a long history of, in fact, being a center of education, of organization, of research, and of social struggles, often against the United States, in which the Iraqi people have proved repeatedly their ability to organize their own affairs far better than the United States has been able to run their affairs. Vietnam has come up as an analogy. I think, first of all, we have to recognize that there were a lot of people in the movement during the time of the Vietnam War who said we shouldn't be calling for immediate withdrawal of troops. And it was incumbent upon a number of anti-war forces to campaign and fight and organize with people in the military to get the troops out. And that, I think, was absolutely the right decision, and I think it applies to our struggle today. And at the end of the Vietnam War, knowing who would or would not take over the country isn't the issue, because it's not our decision. I don't think people in Brooklyn should be deciding who the leadership of Iraq is. I don't think that's ours to say. And yes, the script has changed. U.S. empire did not get every single thing it wanted in Iraq, but the U.S. has adapted, and the elections were part of that adaptation. And we shouldn't confuse that for the changing of the fundamental reasons for why the United States went into Iraq and will continue to play a role in Iraq and in the region, which have nothing to do with human rights, democracy, capacity building. To talk about capacity building for the United States, which has systematically destroyed the infrastructure and capacity of Iraq, I just don't think is credible. The fundamental aims have not changed, and Paul Wolfowitz being shifted to the World Bank is a part of a strategy of continuing to exercise U.S. control through multilateral institutions when they can, but of course knowing that the military and unilateralism are there whenever they need to be called upon to impose U.S. will. We shouldn't confuse Paul Wolfowitz going around the world and saying he's listening to people with a shift in U.S. policy. It hasn't taken place. Malcolm X said, if you stick a knife 9 inches into my back and pull it out 3 inches, that is not progress. I think that's right. We need the knife pulled out of Iraq, and we need reparations. We need to talk about serious social changes in this country. But right now, the immediate issue is getting the knife out of the back of the Iraqi people.